Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic and a member of the Wednesday night study group. My name's Joe Bear. Good to be here. It is, man, I'm telling you, it's such an honor to be asked to do something like this. You know, I take it very seriously. And, you know, I guess, you know, when you've had an experience and you continue to experience this experience, that you have hopefully something that you can transmit. Because they say that you can't transmit something that you don't have. So I don't think that you'll ever have to worry about coming here and with Rachel and James and the gang ever putting somebody up here that hasn't had the experience that they can transmit to you. And I hope that I can do that tonight. And I hope I do it every Tuesday night until I'm done. I want to read you something because, you know, it sounded like we were all in harmony when we just got done reading how it works about that last phrase that we all sang together, that God could and would if he were sought. We all know that phrase. Unfortunately, many don't follow through on the phrase. We know it. We could say it, but it's automatic. That God could and would if he were sought. And that's that third pertinent idea that comes after realizing and conceding to our innermost self that we're truly an alcoholic, a real alcoholic, by the definition given to us in the first few chapters, and that our lives and our thinking had become unmanageable, that no, and that's A, and that B, no human power could have relieved our alcoholism by evidence and fact. We simply need to look over our shoulder and investigate the truth and come to that conclusion. And many of us tried. Everyone. We burned out every human power and every human solution that we possibly could. Many of them walked away for pure self-preservation, saying, I can't help you anymore. Right? And then we come to see that God could and would if he were sought. And we went over this whole thing, this chapter called We Agnostics, and after that coming to those conclusions that gave us the whole argument of why it's better to believe in a power greater than ourselves than not to believe. Well, nobody but an alcoholic knows the devastation caused by alcoholism and selfishness and self-centeredness. Right? That internal condition. That fear of you, that fear of everybody, that fear of the future, the fear of the past, you know, all that stuff that we drink over. Okay? Nobody knows that better than us. And they say, look, what have you really got to lose by believing rather than not believing? Because if you don't believe and you choose not to believe, you will get more of the same. And unbelievably enough, we find out that our problem centers in our mind rather than in our body, doesn't it? If we don't ingest alcohol, we don't aggravate the allergy to where we can't stop. So if we never put it in, we don't have a problem. Our problem is not stopping. It's that we can't stop starting because our mind tells us it's okay. So what happens to most people when they come in here after about 2 or 3 or 4 days, maybe a week, when they start getting a little food in their system, feeling a little better, the color, you know, starts to, the fleshly color comes back rather than the red color. They actually will start to pursue the remedy with the mind that created the problem. I got this. I know what I'm doing. I mean, it's amazing. But you know what? If you don't know that, you just think you're doing what you're supposed to do. Right? We're going to talk about this thing called self tonight. Because they say self manifested in many, many ways is what had defeated us. That we must be rid of this selfishness or it kills us. That it's the root of all our troubles. Right? I want to read something, and I just want you to, especially those of you that are new, within your first year of sobriety, to ask yourselves what these words mean to you. I can only tell you that when it was read to me, I had the most profound experience because it fit me to a T. It's entitled The Masks. says, don't be fooled by me. Don't be fooled by the face I wear, for I wear a mask. I wear 1,000 masks, masks that I'm afraid to take off, and none of them are me. Pretending is an art that is second nature to me, but don't be fooled. For God's sake, don't be fooled. I give you the impression that I am secure, that all is sunny and unruffled within me, within as well as without, that confidence is my name and coolness is my game, that the water is calm and I am in command, and that I need no one. Please don't believe me, I beg you, please don't believe me. My surface may seem smooth, but my surface is my mask. My ever-varying, ever-concealing mask. In fear, in confusion, and in aloneness. Beneath lays no smugness, no complacency. I don't want anybody to know it. I panic and tremble at the thought of my weaknesses and fears being exposed. That's why I frantically create a mask to hide behind. A nonchalant, sophisticated facade to shield me from the glance that really knows. But such a glance is precisely my salvation, and I know it. That is, if it's followed by acceptance and it's followed by love. It's the only thing that can liberate me from my self-built prison walls. I dislike hiding, honestly. I dislike the superficial game I am playing, the superficial phony I am being. I'd really like to be honest and genuine and authentic in me, but I need your help. I need you to hold out your hand even when it's the last thing that my masks are telling you. That glance from you is the only thing that assures me of what I can assure myself. That I'm really worth something, but I don't tell you this. I don't dare because I'm afraid you'll think less of me and that you'll laugh and that your laugh would kill me. You see, I feel that deep down I'm nothing and that I'm just no good and that you'll see this and reject me. So I play my game, my desperate pretending game, with a facade of assurance without and a trembling child within. So begins the parade of masks, the glittering but empty parade of masks. My life becomes a front. I idly chatter to you in suave tones of surface talk. I tell you everything that's nothing and nothing of what's crying and dying inside of me. Please listen carefully to hear what I'm not saying, what for survival's sake I need to say but cannot say. Every time you hold out your hand and take a stand for me, my heart begins to grow wings. Very small, delicate wings. But wings. We come in here so crippled by what people think of us. And for some reason, we think that other people are going to give us the emotional security that we're looking for. And it never happens. When we made this decision to seek, we made a decision to investigate. We made a decision to seek this power, but we've got to find out what's in the way. Get off the train that thinks that it's just not drinking and drugging that is the answer to all your problems. We talked about the internal condition. We talked about the fear, the regret, the remorse, the shame, the embarrassment, the failure, the disappointment, the ridicule, all that stuff that creates this internal condition, which is why I drink. Because the only thing I can sense is the ease and comfort that comes in a split second by putting it in my body. I put it in, I can't stop, I'm down for the count. If you're a real alcoholic, you know exactly what that means. So we're deciding to seek, but then they're going to caution us. Bill, and these people were masters at what they wrote here, because they knew what would get in the way of our intentional, unfettered decision to seek this power source we call God. They know what's in the way. So they're going to tell us. So a lot of the things I'm going to say tonight are going to be reading right out of this book. You know, I could communicate it to you, but it would not be nearly as effective as how they put it in here. Okay? So we're going to be talking about the manifestation of selfishness and self-centeredness. Egoism. Narcissism. that unbelievable innate desire to want to be liked by other people and be popular, be a social butterfly, thinking that that's going to make me feel whole, and it never does. Okay? So they're going to tell me, you know, we make that decision. Hey, Joe, I'm in. James, I'm in. John, I'm in. What do I got to do? And the book says, well, let me tell you this first before we actually do the investigation to show you what we're going to be investigating. Because a lot of us think we're going to be investigating why you made me drink. That's not what the deal is. Right? So we make this decision. We come to the three conclusions. Powerless, power. What am I going to choose? Okay? I choose power. I say I'm in. And here's what happens. Here's where our philosophy and our perception of life get in the way because of our instinctual desires. It says, but the moment our mental or emotional independence is in question, how differently we behave. How persistently we claim the right to decide all by ourselves just what we shall think and just how we shall act. Oh yeah, we'll weigh the pros and cons of every problem. We'll listen politely to those who would advise us, our sponsors, our mentors, our friends, right? But all the decisions are to be ours alone. Nobody is going to meddle with our personal independence in such matters. Besides, we think there is no one we can surely trust. We are certain that our intelligence, backed by our willpower, can rightly control our inner lives and guarantee us success in the world we live in. This brave philosophy, wherein each man or woman plays God, sounds good in the speaking, but it still has to meet the acid test. How well does it actually work? One good look in the mirror ought to be enough for any alcoholic. So they say that we are agreeable to make this decision because we're dying and we're in severe pain, severe loneliness, and all those things in our internal condition. But when it comes to other things, somebody challenging our philosophy or our decision making or our choice making, or what we don't think applies to AA or what we do think applies to AA, right then and there we start to get defensive. We start to tell other people that are begging us to follow this path thoroughly just how we're going to follow it. And I'm going to tell you, a lot of failure goes on out there. Because when we want to argue and we want to debate, we want to negotiate, and we want to insist that that's not for me. That thing you're telling me to do, even though it's 80 years of experience that absolutely confirms that 95% of the time you're going to get drunk behind it, that doesn't apply to me. Right? We start to get this, the ego comes back is what happens, right? In the big book, right after we make that decision, it says this. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Think about this for a minute. Is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, and the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished or she wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. Notice they say, the actor. When you're hiding behind masks, pretending that everything is okay, when everything is crumbling and dying within you, we act, we pretend, we run a masquerade. Because we don't want people to know that. We're too self-conscious. We'd be too embarrassed. They may not like us. They may not think like, they may think that like we're odd or something. Right? It says this. It says, in trying to make these arrangements, our actors may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he's most likely to have mastered all traits. It says he's most likely to have varied traits. I say we are masters of all traits to get what we want. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think that life just doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more, becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious as the case may be. Still the play doesn't suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, and self-pitying. See any of that around the AA? What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages better? Is it not evident to the rest of the players that these are the things that he truly wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? It says our actor is self-centered, egocentric. Selfishness, self-centeredness. That, we think, is the root of all our trouble. If you're having trouble, they say that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of all that. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. Seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that sometime in the past we have made decisions based on self and self-satisfaction that later place us in a position to be hurt. That's what we're going to be doing in this investigation, people. That's what we're going to be doing. And then we find out that we're going to put God in charge and we're going to fire the idiot looking back at us in the mirror from running our life. Unless you really like what you got. My sponsor put it real plainly. He didn't mix words. He says, let's take a look at what you've been able to accomplish with all your ability, talent, and skills in the realm of recovery, Joe. Zero. Zero. All my scorecards read zero. Right? Selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of all our troubles. Let me read this to you. When you go to Wikipedia and you look up selfishness or self-centeredness, you know what it does? It brings you to egomania. It's an obsessive preoccupation with oneself. Think about what you think about on a daily basis. Now, the first 100 say the central fact of their lives, what had transpired through the working of this process, was the absolute certainty that God had entered into their lives and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. That, in other words, that's like, there's nothing more central than that thought that constantly runs in the minds of these people or the people in here that have had that experience. God is everything. God is always on their mind. God is you're having conversations with God. You're talking to people about God. It's all about God. But if you don't have that, you're thinking about you. It says this. Is an obsessive preoccupation with oneself and applies to someone who follows their own ungoverned impulses and is possessed by delusions of personal greatness and feels a lack of appreciation. Someone suffering from this extreme egocentric focus is an egomaniac. The condition is psychologically abnormal. How did they know me? I never had a chance at living a good purpose unless something supernatural was going to happen in my life. It was obvious. The danger with the egomaniac is always that underneath the apparent overconfidence and bravado lies a fragile personality. Driven by grandiose fantasies of boundless success and power or perfect love which cannot be fulfilled. So, what they say, not what I say. That makes perfect sense to me. If you've ever lived from that place, I'm sure there are people in here that haven't. If you're a real alcoholic, you may be a visitor, you may not be one of them. But they say all human beings could have a tendency to suffer from this stuff. This is not exclusive for an alcoholic. We just drank over the damage that it caused in our lives, right? So alcohol worked for us. So we get down, and they say that this decision that we made, that we talked about last week, was a vital and crucial step, but could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things within ourselves, that internal condition, that had been blocking us off. Blocking us from what? The grace of God. The relationship with a power greater than ourselves. That blocking. That choking off. Right? It says, our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. We had to address the truth about the man or woman looking back at us in the mirror. Because if you can't find out what's wrong with you, you're always going to blame them. And you will always drink again because they never change. Right? It says, therefore, we started on a personal inventory. And they talk about this parallel between a business inventory and a personal inventory. And they say when you take a business inventory, and many of you have, you go into your warehouse, you take a full accounting of what's in there. You find out what's damaged and unsellable. Right? Things that aren't selling, you get rid of them promptly without regret. You want to make money. If you kept all that stuff and it didn't sell, why would you, like, close your doors? I mean, that's just stupid, right? Like, there's a TV up on the shelf that doesn't have a picture on it because it's broken. Why would you keep that there? So they say when you go through a business or inventory, you go on this fact-finding or searching, and a fact-facing, you face the facts, you face the truth, or fearless, right, inventory, and it's an effort to discover the truth, another word for moral, about the stock and trade, okay? So we did the same thing with our lives. We went through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty, and made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now, they're going to separate it, and we're going to investigate certain things in our life that will hopefully get us to the other side of where we are able to look at who you got or they got when we showed up on the scene. What was on display? Who was I when I was in your presence? What was I saying? I mean, you know, you can spot, listen, alcoholics can spot alcoholics. We can spot gamers. We're master gamers. I like to say that we were masters of detection, now we're masters of deception, now we're masters of detection. We can see it in all of them because it lived in us. Right? So what we do is they say this thing called a resentment is the number one offender. Alcoholics get really angry with people when they get fed up with us. This thing, resentment, comes from a Latin word, sentire, and to re is to do over. And what they say is that we feel this hurt and this pain and this anger and this bitterness and this rage over and over and over based on what they did to us. So what they do in this inventory sheet, if you notice, if you've ever read the big book, and I'm sure many in here have, the template that they have shows three columns, but they actually, through the writing, address five areas of our life, okay? You're going to hear me talk a lot about instincts of character, these instinctual drives to survive, perfectly necessary and God-given, okay? We're going to investigate these things. Let me just tell you, read this to you. And this is about these instincts. And we're going to find out why we have them. All right? If you ever want to know kind of like what God's will for us was when he gave us these instincts of character, this is what it is. Now, what we've done with them doesn't really resemble what God gave them to us for, okay? Just a saying. It says, creation gave us instincts for a purpose. Without them, we wouldn't be complete human beings. If men and women didn't exert themselves to be secure in their persons, made no effort to harvest food or construct shelter, there would be no survival. We wouldn't be here. It says if they didn't reproduce, the earth wouldn't be populated. If there were no social instinct, if men cared nothing for the society of one another, there would be no society. So these desires for the sex relation, the material, and the emotional security and for companionship are perfectly necessary and right and surely God-given. But yet these instincts, so necessary for our existence, often far exceed their proper functions. So we just read what the proper function of the instinctual drives are for and why we were given them by our Creator. It says, powerfully, blindly, many times, subtly, they drive us, dominate us, and insist upon ruling our lives. Our desires for sex, for material and emotional security, and for an important place in society often tyrannize us. Listen to this statement. Nearly every serious emotional problem can be seen as a case of misdirected instinct. So these instinctual drives, which are going to be central to our inventory, we're going to take a look on how they were affected, on how they were threatened, and how they motivated our every thought and dominated our thinking and literally came to a place of complete destruction in our lives. Okay? They started out as being perfectly necessary and God-given, but we went all out in confusion that. So the first column, and it says, and it's very specific on how we do this inventory. A lot of rehab babies in here. You know what I mean? I call rehab babies because I'm one of them. I went through many of rehab. And I don't know where they get the value or therapeutic value of, maybe there is some, of me writing a life story. But typically when I'm done with my story, y'all are still the problem. You know, I'm not. I'm just not. You know what I mean? That's what I do in my story. We all have our stories, right? I tell you a story to make sure and ensure that you're going to understand me exactly the way I want you to understand me. I could say, you could ask me a question, it'd be a two words answer. But I'm going to give you a 5-minute story because I want to make sure that you understand why my answer is my answer. And that's just the way it is. It's kind of like being late. You know what I mean? If I know I'm going to be late, like to a doctor's appointment or to my sponsor's appointment or lunch, you know, I'm thinking of the story I'm going to tell him of why I'm going to be late. Don't we do that? You know what I mean? If we have something really important, like a job interview or something like that, aren't we thinking about a story? We've got to make sure that they understand why we're late, and it's not really because we were lazy, didn't set our alarm, got out of bed on time. You know what I mean? We don't want to tell them that. But they'd probably honor that more than the story, right? You just got to know that being late plus a good story doesn't equal being on time. Stories are just stories. They're my attempt to make you understand me the way I want you to understand me. And everybody's got them, right? So they go through this, they tell us the resentments are the number one thing we're going to look at. It's the first area of concern on our 4-step inventory. And it says this, it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we've been not only mentally and physically ill, right? Mentally and physically ill, but we've been spiritually sick. And notice what I'm going to say next. It says, when the spiritual malady or sickness, another word for sickness is malady, when the spiritual malady is overcome, then we straighten out mentally and physically. Now, if you're anything like me, I always, every time I came back and crawled back into the rooms of AA for 16 years, had this confused. I was always of the philosophy and the mindset and the determination that as soon as I get me a little jobby job, I get some money in my pocket. I may get a little smile from Susie over there. You know what I mean? I may get a little car. I get my job, my car, my girl. Then I might work on what you guys are talking about. So consequently, it was job, car, girl, drunk. Job, car, girl, drunk. Every freaking time. Every time. For years, right? So they say, resentment is the number one offender. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry, period. Now, many people in here have been instructed to do an inventory from maybe BB, but it wasn't AA. This is AA, out of the book. By going across. Like, what did they... Like, make a list. I identify who it was. Then I talk about what they did to me. Then I talk about what it affected. That way. That's not what this is talking about. There's a period on the end and not a comma for a reason. It means the one exercise that I begin with is simply making the list, top to bottom. So people, places, and institutions, the only thing I need to think about is one thing. Them. Who they were. Because alcoholics, just people in general, but mainly alcoholics, we don't think of two things at the same time really, really well. You know what I mean? We're not real great multitaskers when it comes to this. It's just, you know, just we get confused. So they have us do the list first. So we go top to bottom. We make the list. Then it says, then we asked ourselves why we were angry, period. So we go back to the top, and next to each name or institution or principle, we write what they did to us. What they did to make us angry. That's what it says. What did they do to make us angry? So we get to be really good little victims here. This is like the last part, the last time you're going to be able to really be a victim here is like you name them who it is and what they do. Right? And keep that little Vienna thing. It's the last opportunity. And then it says in most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, or our ambitions, or our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. We cannot get upset or threatened or in fear unless somebody attacks or threatens one of our instincts of character, our personal security, our financial security, our emotional security, or our sexual security. It's just the way it is, right? Just the way it is. When we are in fear or afraid that we're not going to get something we want from them, or we're going to lose something we've already have to you, I'm in fear, right? So we get defensive, we react, we respond. So it says we were hurt or threatened, so we were sore, we were burned up. So it says on our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries, what they did to us, what they do to me. And then we ask ourselves, was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, or our personal or sex relations that were threatened? And on an inventory form, if you have an accurate inventory form, you just simply check it off or write those things down in what within me was affected. Naturally, if it's an individual, your personal relationship is going to be affected with that individual. But there may be collateral damage. It may be the kids. I may be really, really angry with her. Right? But also, the kids may have been affected. Her parents may have been affected. Her sisters and brothers may have been affected. There's a lot of collateral damage that we've got to take into consideration. So we go down the list and we check off what each one has done and what was hurt or threatened. Okay? Then what it says to do. By the way, it says we go back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. Thoroughness and honesty. Okay? When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing that apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. Isn't that perfect? It's their fault. It's not my fault, right? Now, if you only do three columns, that's all you're going to conclude. If you're only going to ask yourself those three questions, you're going to get done and say, it's still their fault. I don't need to change. I don't need to do six. I don't need to ask God for help. Right? I hope I'm stimulating something that didn't want to be stimulated in some of you. Okay? To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and then we were sore ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. It was a lose-lose situation no matter what the deal. Right? So, it says a little bit further down, it says, we turn back to our list, and notice what it says. We've done the first three columns. We listed who it was, what they did to piss us off, and what it affected within me. It says, we turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. So we haven't addressed the key to the future. We're going to do that now. It says, but we got to be prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Means, I'm not going to be able to look at it from a victim. I've got to look at it from a place of accountability to see my part in the deal. All right? It says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs they did, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Oh my God. But that's not the temp. That's not what the picture shows. It only shows three. You know what I mean? This is where we start to argue. It says, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person entirely. Where were we to blame? What decision did I make based on myself that later placed me in a position to be hurt or retaliated against by that individual? And I promise you that there's always something. Now, some of you may be saying, like I was saying, but what about when I was little and the verbal and mental and emotional abuse and the sexual abuse and all that stuff comes into play? Where was I at fault? I don't need to put anything down in that column. That would be column 4. My sponsor said, well, you may not have started the ball rolling, and you may be an innocent victim, but what about the ball that you started to roll from that point forward? What about taking that individual or those individuals hostage to their emotions, knowing exactly what would put a dagger in it, rip their heart apart, that you did for years and years and years? What about this fictitious thing that you held against your father, Joe, that you blamed him for your alcoholism, that you never got your little entitlement and what you thought you deserved from him, that you were so angry with that affected everything in your life? What about all the times you stole from him, knowing it would break his heart? You know, I had to be accountable for that. Because you know what? If I'm not accountable for that, I'm going to continue to do that. I'm going to continue to lie in wait so I can assault those that I feel wronged me if I can't look at my part in the deal. See, we're starting to really get an understanding of what's going on here. Listen, I'm after a spiritual awakening. I'm after an incredibly unfettered, powerful relationship with God. I'm after recreation, being reborn. I'm not after anything that looks like the guy I was. I want that guy to die. And if I can't identify him, I will continue to be him. And even though I have, and even though I work every day, and I have for the last 11 years, he still pops up. He's still there, lying in wait to be self-righteous and egotistical. And condemning. Always, you know what I mean? It's like, all I need is a good opportunity. I don't need permission. So it says, that's what we do. So it says, referring to our list again, putting down out of our minds the wrongs others have done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where had I been to blame? That's column 4. Then we identify, or column 5, whichever way your template has it. But then we identify the defects of character. We identify, what was the motivating force? See, this is all about finding and uncovering our motives to be self-satisfied, to seek more than our fair share than is proper than are due us of these instincts of character. I never sought a relationship with God to be self-satisfied. I sought all my instincts. I never came from a spiritual direction. I came from what I could see, what I could smell, what I could taste, what I could hear, and what I could, you know, that, the five senses. I never had a sixth sense. but I'm starting to undergo one here. I'm starting to see the truth here. If a man or woman never looks at their truth and connects the dots, you ain't got a prayer. You ain't got a prayer. You may remain abstinent, but nobody will want to be around you. You know what I mean? The only people that you'll be able to be around are fellow victims and storytellers. And that's not wellness. Then it goes through fears. We do the same thing with fears. A little bit different format. We ask ourselves why we have them. We identify what inside us, our instincts were threatened, what we did to set the ball rolling, and the motivating force, those defects of character, self-centeredness, dishonesty, being frightened, inconsiderate. There's no inconsiderate in AA, is there? Right? No inconsideration, right? Those four things, fear, dishonesty, selfishness, and inconsideration, branch off. From those stem all forms of spiritual disease. Thus we get our seven deadly sins. Ego, pride, lust, greed, sloth, gluttony. Those things. You know what I mean? And we realize for the first time in our lives, it's not why we stop asking, why is my life so screwed up? When you get done with this, you start saying, well, wow, of course my life is screwed up. How can my life not be screwed up given who I was on display? Given who they got when I showed up? What was in my display case? What was my essence? Who were you getting? And this is the truth. This is the real deal. So I'm going to tell you, you do this properly, you will not want to be anything like the individual you uncover. Because when you uncover this, you will start to see it in other people. It'll show up like bam! Right? Then we talk about our harms and our sexual harms. You know, one of the things that I try to identify a lot in here is, you know, when I talk about a four-step inventory is good old Department of Children and Families. You know, as alcoholics, we go way over the line when it comes to emotional and verbal abuse. And it may be indirect. We may be screaming with her, fighting with her, and they may be in the next room terrified. And we think all we're hurting is her. And eventually it gets so bad that DCF and comes and takes our children. So who are we mad at? DCF, they took my children. So we got the name, we got what they did to us, they took our children. What did it affect? Certainly affected my personal relationships with everybody I know. They thought I was the biggest dirtbag on the planet. And rightfully so, but I didn't think so. My personal relationship with her was certainly threatened. My emotional security, I felt like a complete loser. They took my children. My financial security, I couldn't work, I couldn't think straight. I was making less, so I couldn't be productive. Right? Think about the damage. This is the damage that it does. But I have to look at what I did in the play. What did I do to set the ball rolling? Well, I spent all the money. I abandoned them constantly. I said I was coming home and I was going to do this with them, I'm going to do that with them, and I continually abandoned them on a weekly basis sometimes. I screamed and had arguments, fuel-driven arguments with her. I would take it out on them. I'd punish them. They'd see me fighting with her and beating her up. I couldn't stop drinking and I couldn't stop drugging. I kept going to jail. Let's really look at the truth. Was it DCF's fault? Hell no. They saved my children from me. What were my defects of character? Selfishness, self-centeredness, inconsideration, fear, dishonesty, greed, envy, all of it. See how this works? If we don't uncover what the problem was and who the author was, which was us, we will continue to repeat. I don't think any of us came to AA to keep that crap. And we're going to talk about this next week with another human being in the presence of God. God bless you all.